From NPR News and the Discovery Channel, this is a special report with Ted Koppel, The Price of Security.
The plane just crashed into the World Trade Center.
The American people expect me to do everything in my power under our laws and Constitution to protect them and their civil liberties.
It's been 5 years. What's different?
As of today, we're changing the laws governing information sharing.
I'm Neil Cohn. Congress has passed new laws to combat terrorism. The Bush administration is pushing the limits of intelligence gathering to try to disrupt terrorist attacks before they happen. Thousands of people have been detained at home and abroad. The U.S. military is engaged in difficult wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've all paid a price. Is it justified by the threat?
We will not sit back and wait to be hit again.
Coming up after the news, a town meeting with NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel. From NPR News and the Discovery Channel, this is a town meeting with Ted Koppel, The Price of Security. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 5 years after the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001, what's changed? Have new laws passed since 9/11 made the country safer? Have civil liberties been compromised? What's been the trade-off between security and liberty? Those are the questions discussed in this town meeting. The participants include some of the people who crafted post-9/11 policies, privacy advocates, current and former members of the Bush administration, Congress, the military, and people who have lost relatives in the terrorist attacks. The moderator is NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel.
Discovery and Time magazine commissioned a poll at the end of last month, and I want to give you just a couple of questions that were raised and a couple of reactions from the respondents. And then I'm going to turn that into, or let that evolve into, the first round of conversation here. Here is the first question that we put. Would you favor or oppose a government plan to hold Arabs who are U.S. citizens in camps until it can be determined whether they have links to terrorist organizations? 25% favored that notion, 71% opposed it. You may think that's a large number opposing it, but consider one out of four Americans would be prepared to do that. Would you favor or oppose a government plan requiring U.S. citizens of Arab descent to carry an identification card as a way to prevent terrorist attacks? 47% favor that, 50% oppose it. There is only a 3% margin of error in that poll, so essentially that's even. I'm going to turn now to an old friend, Jim Zogby. And, Jim, what do you think?
Well,
identify yourself first, if you would, please.
I'm Jim Zogby. I'm president of the Arab American Institute and also work with my brother, John Zogby, at Zogby International. So we do a little polling ourselves. The numbers are frightening, Ted. I guess I'm heartened by the 71%, but scared by the 25%. And the 50-50 on national ID also bothers me. It's indicative of a couple things. One, there is a generalized, I think, prejudice that we've seen. 9/11 didn't create it. It's been there. It's been a part of our culture, stereotyping. We talked about it on one of your very first Nightline programs back in the 70s. And I was grateful to you at the time for raising it. Secondly, I think there's indicative in this, a failure to appreciate the values of our country and the Constitution that we hold dear. And thirdly, I think in the post-9/11 world, policies pursued by some in this administration have only exacerbated the prejudice. President said it's not Arabs, but Justice Department behaved as if it was all Arabs, and the roundups and the call-ins and the way we behaved during special registration only reinforced in the public mind, you got to watch out for all these dark guys. And then I think that we have an education work to do. But my sense is that at the end of the day, as we've seen in the last 5 years, as bad as it can get, the American people and the courts ultimately come down on the side of the Constitution. And so I'm frightened, but I'm also confident that at the end of the day, we win this.
Joining us is the Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Paul McNulty. This is, after all, a balancing act in the final analysis. How much freedom are we prepared to surrender in order to have how much security?
I know that's the way in which we framed it, and that's a reasonable way, I suppose. But I'm struggling with that way of setting up the discussion, because I'm not sure if we need to talk in terms of a shift into a new paradigm relating to war versus the institutions that we know and love with regard to the criminal justice system and everything with regard to our values. We don't look at it that way. I think it's a false dichotomy. We are a land that is ruled by law, and that is the way we have to be guided in every decision we make, in every prosecution we bring, in every enforcement action, in everything we do. The life I live day in and day out for the past 5.5 years has been one of discussion about what does the law say in this area? What authority do we have under the law, according to the Constitution? So we can talk about it as war because it is. But even as we proceed forward with fighting this war, we have to understand that we do it according to the law. The other point we have to understand is that when we talk about the issue of losing rights, you don't lose a right more than being killed by a terrorist. We have suffered inconveniences, but in the process of suffering inconveniences, we can't put that ahead of the right to live. And we're responsible in government for protecting that right to live every day. It makes for tough choices, but as we make those tough choices, we do them according to what the law says we can do. We don't have the freedom to ignore it or work around it.
Let me make a couple of observations. First of all, sitting in the back row over there, and I should point out, and I'm really extremely grateful to you all, are 7 family members of those who in fact did die on 9/11. And at some point or another, when you feel like it, and only when you feel like it, wave at me, throw something at me, and you can get into the conversation. For the moment, though, I'm going to ask George Soros, and please identify yourself. Most people just know you as a billionaire.
I have set up a network of foundations devoted to promoting open societies throughout the world. I think that we need to look at what has happened and question the very concept of the war on terror, because I think that is a misleading metaphor, a figure of speech that has led to a real war. That is, we are now fighting on a global front. You've got a lot of different terrorist organizations. Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Sunni insurrection in Iraq, the Mahdi army in Iraq. And so we have to ask ourselves, are we actually feeding into creating more and more terrorist organizations?
All of those organizations, Mr. Soros, existed before 9/11. All of them existed before anything that the administration has done.
No, they haven't. The Sunni insurrection is the result of our occupation of Iraq.
Well,
the Mahdi army.
The Sunni insurrection, forgive me, obviously they didn't need an insurrection. They were running the country. I mean, that was Saddam Hussein's group.
Right. But you look at the number of people who are being killed. Of course, terrible tragedy to have lost 3,000 people. But now there are more than 100 people, Iraqis, killed every day in Iraq. So it's 3,000 people a month, or more than that. So we are creating the very thing that we are fighting. We are actually feeding into terrorism, because terrorism feeds on humiliation and occupation.
Let me, if I may, turn to Tom Ridge. Governor Ridge, you were the first Secretary of Homeland Security. As you hear Mr. Soros talking, does that resonate at all?
Ted, I think there are a couple of different a couple of different things there. First of all, The poll that suggested that the Muslim world is limited to the Arab community, I think, is somewhat misleading, because I think you have to start spinning the globe, and you can start with Morocco and go across Africa, go through the Middle East, and then to Malaysia and the Philippines and elsewhere, and go to Europe. And so the world within which these small groups have embraced this theological notion that it's all right to kill innocents in order to advance a cause is far, far greater than the Arab world. And to the extent that Mr. Soros has suggested that we've created these organizations, they pre-existed 9/11. Their goals may be different, but their aspirational leader, I think, is Osama bin Laden.
Are they more influential today than they were 5 years ago? Because quite clearly, while it is true that al-Qaeda has been decimated and al-Qaeda's leadership has been decimated, in one sense, you've had little franchises opening up all over the world that clearly are causing us more problems than al-Qaeda ever did on its own.
Well, I think the nature of the terrorist organization that we originally identified as al-Qaeda has certainly changed. I think bin Laden is right now much more an inspirational leader rather than a tactical leader. And if you see the different groups, if you take a look at Madrid and you take a look at London and you take a look at some of the other terrorist activity around the world, history may record there's been some nexus to bin Laden. But again, these groups have existed for some time. And the fact of the matter is that bin Laden and Zawahiri and Zarqawi, before he was killed, identified that they were going to focus some of their efforts directly in Iraq in response to our effort to undo Saddam Hussein.
Let me, if I may, turn to General Anthony Zinni, who was a four-star Marine general and CENTCOM commander how many years ago?
Six
years ago. Are we better off today than we were on the day before 9/11, militarily speaking?
Well, obviously not militarily, because I think we're committed around the world, and our military is obviously feeling the strain. I would say that one of the points that we have to remember is we're trying to win hearts and minds. It's an old saw, but that's what we're trying to do out there. And there's an image that we have to present. Many of the young Marines and soldiers that were in the villages of Iraq trying to build trust and work with the local leadership, their efforts were undermined by Abu Ghraib and some of the other events that came
Absolutely.
Out. Much like Governor Ridge, not long after 9/11, a number of Arab Muslim friends had sent me letters of condolences, letters of feeling, you know, really upset about what had happened. One of them said, "My biggest fear is that America will stop being America." And he says, "You're justified in your retribution and retaliation, but please, whatever happens, don't stop being America, because we, in this region, need you to be America."
I read your book, and I remind you of what you used as a foreword to your book from Alexis de Tocqueville. You want to say it, or shall I?
Well, he said that America is great because it is good. If America ever stops being good, it will stop being great.
You're listening to a special program from NPR News and the Discovery Channel, The Price of Security, with Ted Koppel. I'm Neil Conan. To see highlights of the documentary and to download this program, go to our website, npr.org. The conversation continues after a short break.
Thank you.
From NPR News and the Discovery Channel, this is The Price of Security. I'm Neil Conan. The conversation continues now. The moderator is NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel.
I'm introducing Ted Olson right now, who not only was once the Solicitor General of the United States, but you have a tragic personal involvement in what happened on 9/11. Your wife was killed aboard one of those aircraft. Are you entirely comfortable with the fact that the United States seems to be treading a very, very thin line in its treatment of detainees, possibly terrorists, something that either comes dangerously close to torture or is, in fact, torture?
Of course, I'm concerned about our country's treatment of people in our custody, whether they be citizens or people that are captured on the battlefield. But it is important to remember, and I don't have familiarity with the techniques or what has gone on with respect to these things, except what I've read, like everyone else has. We kill people on the battlefield. We capture people on the battlefield, and we put them in custody so they will not go back and kill more of our soldiers. We intercept communications on the battlefield. We are now in a new situation where the terrorists are coming from anywhere. They do not wear uniforms. They do not abide by any of the treaties. They deliberately target civilian targets. They capture schools. They attack bar mitzvahs. They come among us. They don't obey any of the rules. The first words of our Constitution, it's in the preamble, to protect domestic tranquility. The reason, in large part, that people came together to form the United States was to protect the security. And as Paul McNulty said, we don't have much of civil liberties if we can't go freely, if we are in fear of being bombed, if we are in fear that our elementary schools may be invaded and our children killed. The first responsibility of our government is to protect those civil liberties of life.
Now, if you would like to, let's set aside for a moment the question of morality. Let's just talk about it from a purely pragmatic point of view. The United States has lost a lot of ground overseas. If we don't stand for the laws that define us, what do we stand for?
No, I agree with that. And I think that the things that happened at the Abu Ghraib prison and where there have been other abuses have been extraordinarily damaging.
What about in the secret prisons? What about in the black sites?
I don't know what has happened in the so-called secret prisons. Now, let's talk about those secret prisons for a moment. When you capture someone on the battlefield who is throwing a bomb at your troops, you put them in custody somewhere in the battlefield or somewhere away from the battlefield where you are not going to create a greater risk to your troops by where you're keeping the enemy combatants. Is that a secret prison? When we're taking a terrorist
we're not defining that as a secret prison. And the president, for the first time, has, within the past couple of days, has conceded that the CIA has been running secret prisons for the express purpose of interrogating what are considered these high-value detainees. I'm just asking, is that okay under the law as far as you're concerned?
I'm not aware of laws, and I haven't studied this from a legal standpoint, but I'm not aware of laws that when we do capture people in the battlefield or in connection with the battlefield or in connection with acts of terror or conspiracy to commit acts of terror outside the United States, who are not United States citizens, who are not entitled to the constitutional rights of Americans, we can keep them in custody. And I'm not speaking about particular methods of terrorism or where they may particularly be detained, but we can detain non-citizens, aliens who are not part of this country, who are not part of this constitutional pact, which, as Robert Jackson, famous Justice Jackson, once said, our Constitution is not a suicide pact.
Let's go to, who is it who wants to speak over here? Please identify yourself.
Michael Ratner. I'm the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and I want to address briefly the question that was raised about torture and how dismayed I've been really over the last 5 years to see the dialogue in this country and the beginning acceptance of the willingness to use torture. And it's unfortunately continuing when President Bush talked about the secret sites and said we want to continue to use rough tactics. When asked about the rough tactics, he refused to answer. But, of course, we know what some of those are. One of them is, in particular, is waterboarding, which is a classic, you know, drowning of a person and then lifting them up and then drowning until they finally say something. Whether it's the truth or not is another question. But that's what was being used. It's clearly torture. To me, I'm just appalled by it, both because it's illegal, it's immoral, and a lot of the time it doesn't work. And one of the best examples, of course, we have is Al Libby, who was the man who supposedly said that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, that they've been giving those to Al-Qaeda, biological weapons, and was one of the underpinnings, supposedly, of the war against Iraq. So it's extremely, extremely dangerous. My own clients at Guantanamo Bay, Tipton 3, after 6 months of various chained to the floor, stripping, they confessed to being trained by Osama bin Laden in the Al-Farouq training camp. Of course, that didn't happen. They were actually in England at the time that supposedly took place. So from a moral point of view, from a legal point of view, from an effective point of view, I'm really shocked by the fact that in this country we are still hearing about it. And within the next 2 weeks, apparently, Congress will be voting on legislation to essentially abrogate parts of Article 3 of the Geneva Convention so that they can continue, this administration can continue waterboarding.
Congressman Shea, would you please identify yourself in terms of your committee and respond to what we just heard from Mr. Ratner, at least insofar as your expectations with regard to Congress are concerned?
I chair the National Security Subcommittee. It's an investigative committee. I have oversight over the Defense Department, the State Department, Homeland Security. I've had 94 hearings about the terrorist threat, 22 before September 11th, and frankly, we couldn't get anyone to listen. I would love an opportunity sometime to really sit down with Mr. Soros and try to have him understand what I see and what I saw beforehand. We had three commissions. They all said there's a terrorist threat out there. They all said we better have an assessment of it. And they all said we better reorganize our government to implement that strategy.
Well, we've done that.
And you know what happened? We were talking about whether Gary Condon killed an intern. That's what the dialogue was in this country. And what bothers me is we've got to be honest. One of the great things about this country is we got to be honest with each other. And we can't always think we're going to be politically correct. The 9/11 Commission said this. They said, we're not fighting terrorism as if it's some ethereal being. They're Islamist terrorists. That's what they called it. They didn't call it Al-Qaeda. They didn't call it anything other than that. That includes Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Jihad, the Brotherhood. And, you know, you're not going to find them in Iceland. And that's the bottom line. So let's at least acknowledge what the 9/11 Commission did. And they were Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals.
What does that mean, Congressman Shea, in terms of what we've just been discussing?
Well, what it means is I probably would have had half this program about the threat, so you would have a better idea of why people like me are concerned and why maybe Mr. Soros should be. When you go to Los Alamos and you see a scientist who's made a nuclear weapon out of things that I could buy at a Home Depot or Lowe's, you know, that concerns me. When you understand what terrorists can do with radioactive material that they can get from a hospital, combine it with regular conventional weapons, that concerns me. And so give the administration a little slack about the fact that they're more aware of the threat than a lot of people want to be aware of.
All right. Let me turn to a member of the commission, Jamie Gorelick, who was also served as Deputy Attorney General at one point. Please go ahead and give me your sense of where we are in terms of the appropriate balance between security and our liberties.
Let me say first, in following up on what Congressman Shea said, the 9/11 Commission did do a pretty deep assessment of the threat. And one of the things that all 10 of us feel is that we have, in some ways, lost our sense of urgency in dealing with the threat. And we do worry about it. And the other thing I would say, having been in the government myself, is that it is an awesome responsibility when you feel that you are responsible for the safety of the American people. And so I can understand very well the impulse to try to do everything you can. you heard members of the administration talk about the fear that they had when initiating any number of these programs that there would be another tragedy about to occur on their watch. So I'm extremely sympathetic with that. Having said that, I think this is a good moment in time to step back and look at what we have done and decide as a country what the appropriate mechanisms should be. And what, where I think we are to be faulted is that we have not had the debate between the administration and members of Congress, between Republicans and Democrats, that we need to have to understand whether we could condone torture. What are the checks and balances you want to have when you're gathering all of these data? Are these methods working? Are there ways in which we can eliminate the false choice between security and civil liberties? I happen to believe that we can, to a much greater extent than we have. And I think that we need to take the rhetoric level down, and we need to have the involvement level go up. I think there's a great feeling on the part of the American people. They want it out of their minds. I was astonished, Ted, when I wandered this country after we made our 9/11 Commission report at how few people were indeed interested.
Let me make a point here, if I may, and Mr. McNulty, if you'd be good enough to respond to it. What I must confess bothers me a little bit is that on the one hand, we have senior members of your administration talking about the existential threat to the United States. And on the other hand, we have the president saying, go on about your lives, go on about your business, go on vacation. Don't, for heaven's sake, think about raising taxes. Let's lower taxes. Don't worry about a draft, even though we don't have enough troops, and we're sending young men and women back to Iraq for the third and fourth tour. There's a disconnect there. Either we're at war, then we should all be at war, not just the families of the 150,000 young men and women who are over there.
Well, there's no doubt that this is a very different kind of war. It would be a lot easier if the enemy wore a uniform and was fighting on a particular battlefield, and we got reports back every day about whether we were winning or losing on that battlefield. No, this is a war that's fought right around us, where we have operatives who want to kill everyone in this room and would rejoice in the idea of doing it, contacting individuals in our country and seeking to carry out plots to do it. And our job is to try to discover that and stop that. But in the process of doing that, we have to encourage America to be America, or they win already. We have to still be kind of vibrant, prosperous country that is enjoying all the freedoms that we do have under the law.
Forgive me. Let me suggest to you that having America be America doesn't necessarily involve everybody going to Disney World. What it does involve is everybody abiding by the laws that we believe in. If those laws are being violated in any way, and the Supreme Court has now twice in the last few months indicated, or a federal court and the Supreme Court have indicated over the last few months, that the administration has violated the law, that's not the American way.
May I respond to that, please?
Please.
Well, when we talk about the courts deciding that something's been done that wasn't lawful, that doesn't mean that individuals in the administration set out to break the law. It means that sometimes interpreting the law can be a very difficult thing. So in the Hamdan decision, we have a Supreme Court decide 5-4 that military commissions need to be authorized by Congress. The administration believed that under the current authority we had, that they were proper and they could exist. We had the decision about whether Common Article 3 applies, Geneva Convention applies or not to us. An unusual decision. But our reaction was, okay, the court has spoken. Now we abide by that decision. But just because there's disagreement...
Actually, it's not just we abide by the decision. Now we go to Congress. Not 4 years ago, not 3 years
right,
ago. Now we go to Congress and see if we can get Congress to fix it after the fact.
Well, but my point is that just because we have a disagreement as to what the law says doesn't mean that we're ignoring the law.
Point well taken.
That's what the courts are for.
Let me go to Lenny Davis now. And Mr. Davis, if you would just remind us who you are these days and what you're doing.
These days, I'm honored to serve with my colleague, Ted Olson, on President Bush's Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board.
How many meetings have you had?
We've had probably a dozen meetings in the last year, and we are still trying very hard to achieve the balance that we've discussed tonight in our own discussions between civil liberties and privacy rights and the need to get the bad guys. But I really want to say something tonight that reminds us all that we are all Democrats and we are all Republicans. We are all liberals and we are all conservatives tonight. We are all the same when it comes to respecting democracy, as Jamie Gorelick said, debating the issues, trusting the American people. We have purple fingers, too, when we believe in democracy. And checks and balances in the United States Constitution require the President and the Congress and the Supreme Court to be co-equal, to debate, to trust the people, and to tell the story of this administration trying to achieve the right balance in good faith, but trust the people and trust democracy. And I believe the administration needs to tell its case to the Chris Chases and to the members of the public and bring us into your confidence to help us strike this balance that all Americans feel needs to be struck between civil liberties and the war on terrorism.
Do me a favor. Hand the microphone to Viet Dinh back there, right behind you. Mr. Dinh is one of the authors of the USA Patriot Act. And I think you will agree, Mr. Dinh, that part of what has happened over the past 5 years is that the administration has sought not less, but more executive power, that there has been less of an inclination to consult with Congress than in years past because the threat is perceived to be so great. Now, how do you respond to what Lanny Davis just said?
One of the participants in the Constitutional Convention, I think it was Mr. Wilson, wrote, who was chairman of the Committee on Style, wrote that the reason why the executive should be imbued with executive power, the whole of executive power, rather than segregated into the different departments, is it alone can act with secrecy and dispatch. And that is critical in order to preserve the domestic tranquility that Ted Olson had talked about, that is so critical and so fragile in a time of war. We have to recognize that in a divided government like ours, unlike a parliamentary system where it's still unified, our system of government is divided in power. And in a time of war, we need the secrecy and dispatch in that one department that has the full authority to act as commander-in-chief in order to defend our nation.
Are you saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that indeed when some of the people here are suggesting that there has to be more consultation with Congress, that just isn't going to happen and from your point of view shouldn't happen?
No. What I am saying is that, yes, the President has gone to Congress more for more authority, and where appropriate, Congress has given that authority, for example, in the authorization for the use of military force. Where the President has used that authority and the courts have disagreed, the President has gone back to Congress in order to seek that the authority that he thinks is necessary in order to fight this war on terror, just as the President has done in the last week and the Congress is now debating. This is a healthy debate that we are engaging in, and this is part of the separation of powers. This is the Constitution at work and not some sort of crisis or diminution in democracy, as all the critics have made it out to be.
You're listening to The Price of Security from NPR News and the Discovery Channel. I'm Neil Conan. Highlights from Ted Koppel's companion documentary are at our website, npr.org. You can also download this program. The conversation continues after a break.
Thank you.
From NPR News and the Discovery Channel, this is The Price of Security. I'm Neil Conan. Our conversation is about what's changed since September the 11th, 2001. Is America safer? The moderator is NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel.
And if I may, I'd like to begin with Zoe Baird. Clearly, what the president is asking for here is authorization for more, not less, surveillance electronically and in other ways. Tell me what you're doing these days and how that relates to this particular subject.
Thank you. I'm president of the Markle Foundation, and since 9/11, at the Markle Foundation, Jim Barksdale and I have co-chaired a task force of experts in national security and civil liberties who have been looking at the question of what kind of information do we need to fight the war on terror and how do we collect and use that information and at the same time protect the traditional civil liberties that have underpinned this country for so long and that everyone says they agree with. The concern about the collection of information is really at the core of the next generation of what national security means. Information and collaboration between agencies are really the currency of the national security efforts in the 21st century. It's impossible to harden all the targets and to prevent against all speculative terrorist attacks. But the efforts to collect information are not going to be sustainable unless we have the public debate that we're talking about here. And in that public debate, reach a consensus for this country about the balance between security and liberty. We need to agree on what the laws are and what the rules will be. Government agencies are full of people who honor the Constitution and who do not want to collect and share information about people in this country if they think it's going to be abused. So they won't do it. You won't have the information getting where it needs to go to connect the dots unless we have the laws and the rules that empower government officers to do what we want them to do and at the same time constrain them and tell them how not to violate civil liberties. I'll give you a very easy example. We all do Google searches on everybody we know. You meet somebody on the street, you do a Google search to find out who they are. You're going to a meeting, you do a Google search. Do we want an FBI agent to do a Google search on anybody they're interested in, just like you and I can do, or do we want them to forbear and understand that they have the powers of the government behind them and they can cut off people's liberties and that they ought to have a predicate that they think that the person that they're doing some search about is related to terrorism and they ought to document that so that we can oversee it and audit it.
Let me suggest to you, if I may, a simple rule of thumb. If the government can, it will.
I disagree with that. I think we have a long history of a government that tries to follow the laws, and that what we're debating tonight are differences of views about whether this government the last several years has been trying to follow the laws, but we're not debating the question of whether they should try.
You got anything to say on this? This is a subject that you cover all the time, right?
Well, my name is Mark Rotenberg. I'm director of the
Electronic... Well, actually, I wasn't talking about you, but go ahead.
Oh. I feel like I cover the subject all the time.
Well, good. Please.
But I'm still Mark Rotenberg.
And tell me what you do.
Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. We're online at epic.org. And we spend quite a bit of time, actually, tracking issues related to electronic privacy and surveillance. And I think to pick up on the discussion that was just taking place, we certainly think there should be a public debate about what the law is, and if the president believes the changes are necessary, he should go to Congress, and that debate should happen in the open. But I think we also believe that when there is an agreement as to what the law is, it should be followed. And the administration has a particular obligation to uphold the law, and in that way ensure that our constitutional checks and balances are being preserved. Now, I think this is of particular concern when we're talking about electronic privacy, because we know today that there are at least two programs underway in this country, one involving the interception of domestic communications of American citizens, and the other involving the collection of telephone toll records of American citizens, that were pursued by the president without legal authority, without the approval of a judge. Essentially, the president has claimed that he has the power to decide when it's necessary to suspend the law. And I think this is something that should be of concern to Americans, because this is a type of surveillance that is not targeted toward enemies of the country. It's a type of surveillance that reaches the public at large and takes advantage of this technology.
It may be targeted toward enemies of the country, but it throws a fairly wide net. Is that a fair point?
There are thousands of communications that have been intercepted under the domestic surveillance program, and tens of millions of telephone toll records that have been acquired by the administration and the National Security Agency, again, without judicial authority. That is a very large number.
Let me turn to the Deputy Attorney General, Mr. McNulty. True?
No. The problem with this kind of discussion is everyone thinks they're an expert in the law, and it's such an easy statement to make without legal authority. Now, Mark is a very bright person, and he makes a living advocating a particular perspective about the law. But the law is very complicated in an area like this. You have layers of issues. You have the Fourth Amendment, what it provides, what it protects. You have the Article II, the president's authority. You have the issues of different privacy laws that are in effect. You have requirements to go to courts, and you have areas where we're not required to go to court.
But this is one where you are required to go to court, it turns out.
No. I think you're referring to one judge in Michigan who recently made a ruling.
Federal judge.
Which even the New York Times said was a bad decision.
It may be, but it hasn't been overruled yet, has it?
And we're abiding by that judge's decision, which, by the way, it's the decision was held in abeyance while the Court of Appeals takes up that review. The point is, we always try to work at what the law says and not look at a law, read it, see if something's prohibited, and say, okay, fine, we'll do it anyway.
Point well taken. I'm not trying to cut you short. We have a relative of Carol?
Yes.
Tell me your full name, please.
Yes. My name is Carol Ashley, and my daughter Janice, 25 years old, was killed in Tower 1 on September 11th. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the surveillance issue, the points that have been made, very interesting. I agree there should be a debate, absolutely, on where these issues impact the people. The large data mining programs, is that an invasion of privacy? But once you get to a human agent, once a connection has been made between this point A and this one, and they suspect terrorism, at that point, shouldn't the FISA law kick in? When a human analyst gets to the point where he's listening in on your conversations or reading your emails?
When you talk about the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, why would that kick in at that point?
Well, doesn't it apply to U.S. persons who are being under surveillance? They need to have justification under the court. There also, we need oversight of what kind of surveillance is happening. And this is where the debate in Congress must take place, too. We have a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which was recommended by the 9/11 Commission. However, Congress did not put forth the robust board that was needed. They have no subpoena power, and the Attorney General and the Department of Defense can say to them, you may not investigate this particular surveillance.
I'll tell you
that
what.
It's not an independent board.
We're going to jump around a little bit here. Mr. Hamdani. Mr. Hamdani, you were good enough to fly in from Houston. Tell us who you are, what you do, and pick up anywhere you like.
Sure. My name is Alumdar Hamdani. I am the first South Asian or Muslim board member of the ACLU of Texas. I'm a civil rights attorney in Houston, Texas. And one of the things I represent are the people that Tom Rich talked about. And that is not only Arabs, but I am South Asian and I am Muslim. And the clients I represent in that role are usually, like my father, a cab driver or a convenience store clerk who was being approached by the FBI. And, you know, I heard a lot of things today, and Lanny Davis said we are all the same. In the eyes of the government, whether they're electronically surveilling or whether they're being approached by the FBI, I would argue we're not all the same in the eyes of the government. And there's one thing I understand. People who share my culture, my religion, or my visage are looked at with eyes that are jaundiced by the deeds of Muslim terrorists. I get that. But it is one thing for my neighbors or the guy at the airport to look at me with those jaundiced eyes. It is another for my government to do so. And so,
in what respect do you feel that your clients have been treated that way by the government? In what respect do you feel you've been treated that way by the
government?
Sure.
The clients, all of the clients I represent, they've all been targeted because of one factor, because they're Muslim. For example, a man was driving down the highway. He's with his wife, who's obviously Muslim, takes a picture. He's questioned because he took that picture of what could be the sunrise or the power line. Myself, I was traveling in the airport, and one day I swiped my card, and I heard the ticket agent whisper because I couldn't get my ticket. And she said, he's on the no-fly list. And so at that point, I realized that I, a Muslim, maybe because I'm Muslim, well, I'm on a secret government list. Let's not forget what Benjamin Franklin said. Those that sacrifice essential liberties for temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
All right. We are going to move around a little bit now. Mr. Wilkerson, you were at one time the chief of staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell. You've been a harsh critic of the administration that you served in the context of what we've been talking about this evening. Why?
Well, you've already announced me. I'll just say that I'm from William & Mary and the George Washington University, and that I spend a lot of time teaching this very subject. In fact, the title of your program tonight is a major theme in what I teach. And I've been struck by, as Gore Vidal said, we are the United States of amnesia. I'd have to agree with that. I've been struck by some of the comments that have been made here that sort of ignore history. One person even said that it was a false choice when you talk about sacrificing security or sacrificing your civil liberties for security. We've been debating this since 1945. Some very bright people, arguably a lot brighter than us, Dwight Eisenhower, Harry Truman, George Marshall, Ferdinand Eberstadt, Walter Lippmann, a host of other people debated this when they forged the 1947 National Security Act. But what I find stunning is that they were up against the Soviet Union. Yes, we were a colossus. We were the only ones who had nuclear weapons. We were astride the world. We were different, very different. Talk about a paradigm shift. That was a paradigm shift. So they crafted this 1947 National Security Act and all that flowed from it in order essentially to deal with what we're talking about tonight, the conflict between the national security state and our civil liberties.
Do me a favor. Just pass the microphone two over to Mr. Mora. I want, right there. I just want you to have a chance to wrap up because you, as I said earlier on, you had the equivalent rank of a four-star admiral. You were the chief counsel for the Navy at the Pentagon, and yet you have incurred the wrath of this administration by some of the things you've said. I want to give you a chance to wrap up at least part of what we've been talking about here this evening.
Returning to the subject of detainee treatment and torture, I accept fully the notion that the coupling of terrorists with weapons of mass destruction presents an existential threat. And I accept fully, having been a member of the administration, the good faith of every member of the administration in dealing with this threat. The approach has to be aggressive. But let's make no mistake about it. America will cease to be America if we accept the application of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or torture as one of our tools in the war against terror. And the simple reason for that is because it annuls and repeals the belief of our forefathers that every person, not just every American, has certain inalienable rights, and certainly among those rights must be the right to be free from cruelty. And if we now say we can apply cruelty as a matter of a policy option, and that the law does not prohibit that, regardless where the person who is being applied the cruelty is located, then we'll have trumped the basic foundational belief of our democracy and a lot of bad things to our legal system, our constitutional order, our system of values, our foreign policy, and our ultimate success in the war on terror will flow from that basic decision.
All right, let me go to another one of our family members from 9/11, Donna Gabriella. Would you stand, please?
First, I'd like to say that as family members, our family members paid the ultimate price for lack of security with their lives. And I think that when you talk about the United States of amnesia, we're forgetting about how many lives were lost and the threat that's still there. If there were a terrorist attack tomorrow, this conversation would end. Fear would again reign. I think that we really need to focus on what we need to do as a nation to balance security and civil liberties. I have the privilege of working now on a port security project. It's a $6 million Department of Homeland Security project to train port security personnel. There's a lot going on now that is good. We're not talking about what we can do as a nation to pull together and get through this. I'm tired of the politics, personally.
I'm so grateful to you for making a point that really was the genesis of this broadcast tonight and of this town meeting. And that is, if, when the next terrorist attack occurs in this country, this kind of a conversation will be all but impossible, if not impossible. We're down to our last couple of minutes. Jamie Gorelick and Ted Olson, would you wrap up for us?
I'd like to say three things. One, if this is a long war...
Former Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick.
Then the paradigm of the strong executive to whom we defer in periods of war doesn't really work, because that would be true where there's a fixed period of time and a fixed geography. If we're in this for the long haul, we have to have more debate and a better balance between our branches of government to come to the right judgments. Second, I think we've not come to some of the right judgments because we haven't fully debated what they mean. And what I particularly want to focus on as we come to a close is this issue of values and the way we project ourselves in the world.
We are down to our last minute and a half. I want to give it to Ted Olson. Go ahead.
My experience as a member of the Department of Justice,
former Solicitor General Theodore B. Olson,
Privacy and Civil Liberties Board, tells me that while there have been mistakes that have been made by the government and there have been abuses, there's an extraordinarily high level of sensitivity to civil rights, privacy, and obeying the law in all parts of our government. Some of the meetings that we've had on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board have shown us how many steps have been built into the programs that we've been talking about to be conscious and sensitive to these things. And the civil servants, the overwhelming number of people that are involved in these programs, are career government employees who are very sensitive to those things. So while this debate is very important and very good, and it's very good that we criticize our government, it's also important to understand that there are tens of thousands of people that are sensitive to these concerns that are trying to protect American civil liberties.
I thank you, Mr. Olson. I thank all of you. I realize that I have not come to each of you, and I have not gone to each of you as often as perhaps you felt I should. One observation on security. There is, I believe, only one country in the world that can guarantee absolute security against terrorism. Absolute security. North Korea. That would be at the cost of every and all liberties. What we're talking about here is a calibration of the balance between security and liberty. As you have heard and as you have seen this evening, it is an enormously sophisticated and complex debate. I only hope that we have more of it before it's too late. I'm Ted Koppel. Good evening.
Thanks, Jack.
You've been listening to a special program from NPR News and the Discovery Channel, The Price of Security. This program can be downloaded at our website, npr.org. For NPR Senior News Analyst Ted Koppel, I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.